Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. Another week has come and gone, and Republican lawmakers are still showing no signs of reaching a budget deal in Madison. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and Governor Scott Walker met on Wednesday to talk about how they can come together on a plan to pay for transportation. On Wednesday, I spoke with State Representative Beth Myers, a Democrat from Bayfield. She represents the 74th Assembly District and offered her two cents about the ongoing budget deliberations.
There's definitely conversations happening behind closed doors. My office is right next to the room where the Republicans caucus. And we've seen, you know, several days of meetings happening in the closed door room where they're caucusing on the budget issues. I'm not seeing a lot of people in the hallways chit-chatting. The Democrats would be very receptive to be invited to meetings where we talk about the budget, because we're 12 days late right now with signing a budget. And we owe it to the people of Wisconsin to get this accomplished.
Well, what does it mean to residents if this budget deal drags on, you know, if we don't see a deal anytime soon?
Most people in Wisconsin are not budget watchdogs. They're not waiting by their TVs or their radios to hear what we're doing next. But it's a rippling effect. For instance, in transportation, construction companies need to know how much money they have to budget with for projects. And right now, we're not letting them know. So that delays the project going forward. Our highways are in the fourth worst condition in the country. So this is something we should be working on quickly. Of course, in Wisconsin, as opposed to Florida, we have a very short construction season. And any delay postpones these projects for another year sometime.
Well, and it's kind of ironic because the whole reason we have the delay is because of the fact we can't reach a deal on transportation to pay for road repairs.
We need to figure out a revenue source, and that decision should not be made on whether or not a governor is running for re-election. 2 years ago, when we met with people in the transportation industry, they said we need to come up with a revenue source, whether it's a wheel tax or a gas tax or an increase in registration fees. Everything should be on the table to figure out how we're going to solve this near crisis in Wisconsin for transportation.
Well, and what are your thoughts on a proposal that, there's been recent talk of a new tax on heavy trucks, which would raise about $250 million each year over the two-year budget?
I haven't looked at that in detail yet because it's just being proposed, but trucks are now paying a pretty high cost already for using our highways. I don't remember the number of how much their fees are, but that doesn't seem like a fair way to try to get a revenue source on the backs of the truckers in this state.
Okay. Well, we talked before about that the budget, as we're talking, is 12 days late.
Right.
So do you get any sense that we are anywhere closer to a deal? I mean, when do you think this budget will be passed?
Right now, Joint Finance hasn't met for 3 weeks, and Joint Finance will have to have a meeting before this can take place. And to the best of my knowledge, nothing is scheduled for next week either. So the Republicans need to figure out what they're going to do behind these closed doors to get this budget to the light of day, so that not only can the Democrats see what the budget looks like, citizens in the state of Wisconsin can review it. I'm hearing it may not be passed until sometime in September or October or even later than that. But again, the budget is all about our priorities, and it's what we're hired to do, pass a state budget. It's a $76 billion budget, and it should be our number one priority.
What are Democrats doing at this time?
Well, we're waiting to see what proposal is going to come forward because we haven't been invited to the conversation. And if you look at what's happening at the federal level with health care, it seems to be the same way right now, where the majority party is having a conversation with themselves and their lobbyists and their stakeholders, but we're not invited to the conversation.
Well, how is that different than how Democrats have acted? I guess at least at the federal level, where the health care legislation currently in place was crafted without much input from Republicans.
I always kind of chuckle on the inside when people bring up historic events. And my comeback is, let's not look backwards as to what maybe the Democrats did wrong or what the Republicans did wrong 8 years ago or 12 years ago. Let's look forward, and how can we do this better today? We're all elected to represent our constituents, and when some of us are not invited into the room, that means the people of the 74th Assembly District are not being represented, and that's not fair to them.
Again, that was State Representative Beth Myers of Bayfield. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said after Wednesday's meeting that he's come to accept there won't be any new tax or fee increases to pay for roads in the next state budget. As Sean Johnson reports, Voss says that means there shouldn't be any new borrowing either.
Voss has said throughout budget negotiations that Assembly Republicans want a long-term answer to road funding that reduces debt in Wisconsin's transportation fund. He's been open to a variety of tax or fee increases, including most recently a mileage-based fee on heavy trucks. But with Governor Scott Walker and Senate Republicans firmly opposed to raising taxes or fees, Voss says the state can't afford to borrow more.
I have accepted the reality that they don't want to raise revenue. They need to accept the reality that we're not going to borrow and spend. We could be together fairly quickly if everybody could accept everybody else's reality.
Voss's proposal would mean there'd be no new spending on roads. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald's office called Voss's position unrealistic because of all the road projects throughout the state that would be delayed. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Voss says he hopes he and Fitzgerald can meet with the governor again next week. The budget is 2 weeks late, but current spending levels will continue for the time being. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. This week in Bayfield County, attorneys for the county and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources were set to go to court on Monday over the county's South Fish Creek ordinance. But instead, the two have entered into formal settlement talks. The county and state have been at odds over the ordinance because the county wants to protect water quality by placing more restrictions on large farms known as CAFOs that locate in the South Fish Creek watershed, which flows into Lake Superior. Iowa-based Reichsview Farms has proposed building a farm upstream for around 26,000 hogs. That proposal has pretty much stalled in the state's permitting process as regulators wait for more information from the company. Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels-Allison spoke with me recently about their discussions with the DNR.
There were five key items that, there are probably more than that, but five significant items that the county was really hoping for with the South Fish Creek ordinance. And those included an increase in the manure storage days, restriction of spreading in the winter, creation of spreading windows throughout the year, a no-spreading policy within 48 hours of a forecasted rain event, and a lower phosphorus index than is currently allowed. So those were areas, all of those areas are addressed in the Bayfield County South Fish Creek ordinance. And it was our goal to get those addressed. So far, in our very preliminary discussion, it looks like there's some movement that we could get. The county's goal is to, we submitted the ordinance. It was approved by our county board. We submitted it to the DNR, and the DNR did not give us approval of our ordinance to go into effect. So now we're talking with them, trying to see if there are some mutual adjustments that could be made that would allow the ordinance to go into effect.
So what seems to be the items that they're willing to negotiate on then?
Well, we're we're kind of very preliminary. We've gotten some indication, but I think that will really come out in the weeks and month ahead as discussions continue. So that'll be kind of a part of the formal discussion.
Okay. So you're saying you can't say specifically at this time what it is that they're willing to negotiate on?
Well, you know, the county's position is that obviously what we have in the ordinance, it's there for a reason. And so we're interested in negotiating on, or we're interested in discussing all of those items. And we just have to see, we haven't met face to face, and so we need to see what that's going to look like. If the compromises are something we can live with or not.
Okay. And if you're going to be going through these settlement talks, any timeline for that or how close you are?
I don't think that's set as of yet, but our goal would be sooner rather than later. We want to keep this going.
You know, just kind of to paint the picture, why is this so important for the county?
Water resources are critical for the county. We think that we have some geological conditions, some soil conditions, climate conditions that are not the same as the rest of the state because of our proximity to Lake Superior and the tremendous number of inland lakes and waterways. These protections that we passed in ordinance form we think are important to protect the waters of Bayfield County and surrounding areas. That's the critical aspect. That's the purpose of the South Fish Creek Ordinance.
Again, that was Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels Allison. A spokesman for the Wisconsin DNR declined to comment on the talks. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Just after the 4th of July holiday, Washburn Mayor Scott Griffiths announced that he would be stepping down as the city's mayor next spring. Griffiths is planning to pursue an MBA and grow his online websites in the private sector. He has led the city for the last 5 years, and Griffiths spoke with me on Thursday by phone about his decision to step back from the political arena.
You know, I definitely have mixed feelings about it. It's been a really, honestly, a fantastic experience to be mayor and to just kind of play this role. But at the same time, I have some reservations about stepping down. You know, I know I'm going to miss it, but at the same time, I am excited to move on to the next chapter. I've also been building a business online for the last about 10 years now, and it's starting to. It's hitting a point where it just really needs some focused attention from me. I've really kind of let it fend for itself for the last 6 years, and it needs some attention from me, or else it's just gonna continue to languish. And I realize there's a piece of me being in this position kind of mid-career that you notice that most small town mayors aren't usually entering into this field in the middle of their careers. There's a part of me that really understands that, you know, in order to do the job well, it does require some energy and some focus and some time. And, you know, so a lot of the folks that end up running for mayor of small towns like this are doing it after they retire and they have a little bit more free time on their hands. Because I've been self-employed primarily, I've had the flexibility to allow it, but it's also led to me not necessarily putting as much attention and energy into the things that I need to make a living and to be able to retire at some point and whatnot. So those are all different pieces that weighed in on the decision.
Okay. You know, I'm just curious about your time as mayor. You've been mayor for 5 years. And are there things that you look back on that you're happy that you've accomplished in that time?
You know, I think really when I look back over my time as mayor, for me, and I've often said this, that I feel like the primary job and the role that I had as mayor was to help set the tone. I think that when I decided to make a run for mayor, part of what I was frustrated about was not necessarily anything specifically that was going on with within the city, other than watching council decisions happen on a 4-3 majority on a regular basis. And to me, I feel like with the divisiveness of state and federal politics, we have an obligation to do better than that at the local level. So I'm not a huge favor of democracy working in the way that as soon as you get a one vote majority that you just win and you move on. I think that we have an obligation to do better than that and to work harder to reach something that is more palatable, more consensus based for a larger portion of the population. And that's what I worked really hard to do. I think the record would show, if you were to go back over council decisions and read minutes over the last 5 years, that there have been very, very few decisions that have ever been passed on a 4-3 on a 4-3 margin. And that's something that I took very seriously. And so what I see now in the culture within the municipal government here, the city council, is that we've got a council that is working really well together, that is willing to dive in and sit and do the hard work of having more in-depth conversations about how to find the best solutions, and not just walk in with your mind made up and know that you've got a majority and you can walk in and have a 3-minute conversation and vote and win and then move on. So it may be a quick way to do things, but I don't think it's the right way. I feel like even with me taking a step back, that the culture's been created at the council level that would allow for that to continue. So that, you know, so I wouldn't say that from where I sit, it's about the projects that have been done or the development pieces that have been done. That to me isn't really, I don't think that that's where I would mark the accomplishments. I think it really, to me, comes from tone and culture.
And as far as looking ahead, you know, now that you're leaving the city and looking to pursue your own ventures, I mean, what do you think are going to be the biggest challenges for Washburn?
Well, you know, I think that there's a piece of what we, when we look at a town of this size in a semi-rural environment in northern Wisconsin, the society as a whole really looks at growth as the metric by which we measure our success. And I think that it's really important for us to consider that maybe that's not what we use as our metric. And so it's a little bit tough to fit within the existing paradigm when the whole paradigm is based on how fast things are growing. And really, we don't see that kind of growth here. And I don't think that we are going to in the immediate future. And I don't know if anybody really wants to see it. So instead, I think we have to start understanding what is it that we really want to measure that helps us understand how we're doing. And so the challenge is that oftentimes revenue and what it takes to actually run a city of this size, the costs continue to go up, and the only way that the revenue continues to go up is with growth, and that's a challenging fiscal model. And so I see that as continuing to be a challenge here. You know, we're not seeing a lot of development, although anecdotally we are starting to see a few more homes being built. And I think that what we've just done with acquiring the former broke down palace building, I have all the faith in the world that we're going to, now that building's empty, that we're going to see somebody come in and do something exciting with it. It's a really prominent building right in the center of our downtown. And I'm really excited that there's an opportunity for that to have a new chapter. You know, so I think there's a level of patience that's required at the municipal government level. And I think there's also a little bit of a misnomer about what municipal government does. And, you know, I think there's a lot of times when people are seeing things that they want to see something happening, they often look to the city itself, say, well, why isn't the city doing more development? And really, I think there's a little bit of a confusion about what the role of municipal government is. And the role of municipal government isn't necessarily to do development. The role of municipal government is to make the conditions right that the type of development that we want to see will be pursued by the private sector. And so I think that's part of my desire as well, is to start moving back towards the private sector and help develop entrepreneurialism in the region, and maybe try and see if we can find some investors that are excited about what they see here, even though it's not a rapid growth model. that this is a great place to live, and it's an incredibly high quality of life, and we live on the largest body of fresh water in the world. It's a very important place. So those are, I think, kind of some of my general, feels a little bit like ramblings about what's going on in the city now and where the city's going, but that's kind of some of my general thoughts about it.
Well, what would you like to see in the next leader of the city? And do you have anyone in mind that you would throw your support behind?
I do. That person has not necessarily agreed that they're interested in stepping into that role yet. I do have someone in mind, and I'm hoping that they will consider that move. But at this point, I wouldn't feel comfortable sharing any names until they had an opportunity to make a decision one way or the other. But I guess really for me, the big piece is that it's understanding that the city is moving along at a trajectory that is, I feel, sustainable. And I want the culture of collaboration and consensus to continue. I mean, that's the piece to me. I want someone who's going to continue to listen. You know, I had someone the other day come into my office and he was kind of expressing a little bit of disappointment that I was not going to continue. And he and I had a rocky start when I first got elected. Matter of fact, one of the first phone calls I got after my first city council meeting was, "You just made your worst enemy." I was like, holy moly, I've only had one council meeting and I just made my worst enemy. Stopped and went to his house. And I said, "Hey, you know, what's going on? Like, why is that your response to what just happened?" And he and I, over the last 5 years, have developed an amazing working relationship. And so what he came in and said to me the other day was, you know, "I'm really sorry to see you go, because what I like is that I feel like you listen to both sides, and that you're willing to bend, and that you're willing to change your opinions based on what you hear." And, you know, I think that that's a big challenge with politics in general, is that, you know, people get labeled as flip-floppers or something along those lines at the state and federal level. And it's like a put on, as they say, this tarnishing mark on their record. And to me, if you're not actually listening to your constituents, and you're not willing to actually consider what you're being told and be willing to change your opinion on something when you get more information, that's crazy. And so that to me is what I hope for in the next mayor, is that they're willing to continue to listen to all sides of an issue and really do the work that it takes to help find the best solution, not just the most efficient or the easiest solution.
Again, that was Washburn Mayor Scott Griffiths talking about his decision to step down as the city's mayor next spring. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk about a grant that Superior received this week to move forward with plans to restore dunes on Wisconsin Point. Plus, we'll talk about plans this weekend for Lake Superior Day. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Governor Scott Walker's office announced this week more than $2.4 million in grants would go toward coastal communities in Wisconsin. The city of Superior is receiving the largest chunk of change from that pot of money. The city was awarded nearly $1.4 million that will go toward restoring dunes at Wisconsin Point on Lake Superior. Superior Parks and Rec Director Linda Cadott spoke with me by phone yesterday about the grant and how it will be spent.
So this is the construction portion of the grant that, you know, we just completed the engineering phase of the project a few months back. Great public input, a nice team of stakeholders involved with the engineering for this project. And so happy to see that NOAA was able to release the funds through Wisconsin Coastal Management, and we've got bids back from the construction. So now we are really just looking at what portions of the project that can fit in within that grant and what other funding sources the city may be able to use just to complete the full project as engineered.
So this would pay specifically for the contractors who are doing the work out there?
Yes.
Okay. And so you said you've received in some bids. Any idea on when you're hoping to make a decision?
You know, there are some things that are contingent on. It's kind of been all these different parts moving forward at the same time. Right now, NOAA is doing the government consultation process, which is the Section 106. And the Section 106 is, you know, the National Historic Preservation Act. It requires federal agencies to advise with the SHPOs, which is the State Historic Preservation Office, and also the TIPOs, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officers. You know, the whole entire Wisconsin Point is a burial ground, and it's historical and cultural significance. And so this process is not only really good just to make sure that any tribes in the region who are interested in voicing of concerns, and just kind of it's their formal process of flushing that out. So that is in process right now. And then there's also an EA, environmental assessment, that needs to go into the public review stage as well. So if both of those wrap up as they are expected to at the end of August, we would begin the project as early as September, which would then be focusing primarily on the invasive species that go to seed in the fall that are best treated in the fall. So there'd be some treatment of invasive species, potentially some, you know, movement of sand to kind of backfill some of the dunes and the lots that are being consolidated. But it just really kind of depends on timing, but we hope to bring it forward to the second council meeting in August for a formal award.
Well, and, you know, I know that the tribal consultation is an important piece of that project, and, you know, we've seen things recently in the news related to the Fond du Lac Band and consultation issues with Minnesota DOT on that Highway 23 project. So what would the consultation here cover? I mean, is that covering what areas are appropriate for this project, or is there any doubt at all that this project would happen?
You know, I think that especially Fond du Lac has really expressed that they have been pleased with our inclusivity of all the various stakeholders, and including them, and wanting to make sure that everyone has a voice and that things are addressed. The last thing anyone would want to see is, you know, the project started and then stopped because something was discovered, or stopped altogether because the right input wasn't garnered ahead of time. So I really don't anticipate the project not moving forward. You know, what may end up happening is slight changes. You know, there was ground penetrating radar that was completed as part of the initial engineering, and it's still it's up to the TIPO of Fond du Lac to determine, and Fond du Lac Tribe to determine whether or not they want to release that information and make that public or not. So, you know, we're waiting on that. And I believe, I want to say there's 4 or 5 other, you know, tribes total that are giving input on this site. It is such an amazing, beautiful, incredible gem that we have right next, you know, right in our city. And so it makes perfect sense to me that anyone who has a vested interest, and especially because of the cultural resources that are located there and all the history with Wisconsin Point. So even after this process, once the construction begins, there'll be shovel testing. You know, there's a lot of things that we are doing to make sure that everything that we could possibly, you know, hopefully think to avoid from happening to happen or to not happen, you know.
So can you kind of just summarize, too, what the parameters of the project are again? I mean, it's 20 parking lots? the lots that are currently there are going to be consolidated?
So there are roughly 21 little turnout sites, a couple more formal asphalt sites, but basically what has been identified and numbered over the year are 21 sites. This project will consolidate and enhance and expand the parking areas. So it'll consolidate the 21 into 7 different spots. 2 of them include Eloise Bay water access. So there's more of a rustic launch or a canoe landing, as we like to call it. And then there's a boat landing that will have, you know, a few improvements to it as well, including parking, you know, for be able to have trailers. There's so many different uses and people who like to utilize the point for, you know, from duck hunting to bird watching, from hiking to biking, from swimming to taking photos, watching wildlife. What we tried to do is really look at you know, being able to access and not take away from any of those highlights of the, you know, 2.7 miles of beach. And a great exciting part of this project, and really the reason the grant was awarded, is for the restoration. So that's why, you know, we're consolidating. So all of the dunes that have those drastic cuts in them from human traffic and use will be revegetated, restored, and also Eloise Bay shoreline will be stabilized. And, you know, like I mentioned, the invasive species. So it's a great opportunity for the, you know, for the person who's going out there to have better access, both ADA because of the need to go over the sensitive dune areas with boardwalks, but then it's also, like I said, the benefit is it's now ADA accessible. People who don't like to go out there because they can't walk in the sand now have viewing platforms in different areas, but yet still maintaining the natural integrity of and minimizing the impact of all of the different people who like to enjoy it.
And so if you're able to start awarding projects in August, as you hope, I mean, when would you see the project finished?
You know, it's going to be a 2-construction season project. We're looking at next fall wrapping up a second or possibly even third treatment of invasive species. So, you know, as early as this fall, then spring, then fall again. You know, we have a very limited window in this area for any asphalt plants being open and that sort of construction to occur. So that would most likely be held off until the spring. However, you know, depending on timing, there's a chance that that would occur somewhat this fall as well. So, you know, I guess I ask for people to be patient and you know, keep their ear to the ground on the upcoming progress and timing of the project.
Again, that was Linda Cadott with the City of Superior talking about ongoing efforts to restore dunes at Wisconsin Point. A bike share program in Superior could become a reality as soon as next spring. As Felicity Bosk reports, Superior Mayor Jim Payne wants the city to invest surplus money the city has brought in through a tax on lodging to lease bikes for the program.
Superior Mayor Jim Payne says he was elected on a campaign that included plans to enhance transportation options in the city. As part of that, Payne says he would like the city to invest $72,000 for 2 years to start a bike share program using surplus money that's been collected from a tax on lodging. The program would allow people to rent bikes for a period of time. Payne says the money would be used to buy and maintain the bikes.
So we need to make sure that we are valuing all forms of transportation equally, not just motor vehicle traffic. So I firmly believe that the very best way to get around the city of Superior is some way other than a vehicle. It's a relatively geographically small and flat city, and so bicycles and pedestrians can get around far more effectively than vehicles can.
Payne says the city needs to support infrastructure that encourages alternate modes of transportation and Superior's trail system.
That means bike lanes on streets. It means wide, safe, well-maintained sidewalks. It means well-maintained trails through our recreational and even non-recreational spaces, undeveloped spaces. So it does take infrastructure investment, and that sometimes requires a little bit of a shift. But the best way to do that is to start by looking at the way people are moving around our city right now.
Superior's mayor hopes the program will attract private partners to support the bike sharing initiative. Felicity Bosk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Superior's mayor says the $72,000 from the lodging tax would cover the cost to lease 4 bike stations in the city for 2 years. After that, he says additional investment would be needed to support the program. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. This weekend, cities around Lake Superior will be celebrating the Big Lake as part of Lake Superior Day. Washburn, Ashland, Bayfield, Port Wing, Superior, and Duluth are all holding events to mark the occasion. The Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve is hosting an afternoon of music and fun at Barker's Island in Superior. The reserve's education coordinator, Deanna Erickson, spoke with me on Wednesday about what's on tap this Sunday and the history behind Lake Superior Day.
Lake Superior Day is a lake-wide event. It was started partially led by former City Councilman Bob Brown from the City of Superior with the former Lake Superior Bi-National Forum to have just one day every year where everybody who lives around Lake Superior just celebrates it. And I believe it started in the 90s, and it's been going strong ever since. There's usually about 50 events around the lake every year.
And so why, you know, was it thought to be important to get together and just celebrate the lake?
Well, I think we all appreciate it so often. You know, even if you just see it once in a while when you cross over a bridge or you head out to the beach for the afternoon. But we never have sort of a focused event that's about it. And I think that one day every year just being like, hey, this Lake Superior, for one, we drink it. For two, it fuels, you know, a lot of our economy through the shipping industry. But for three, it really makes our place what it is. And just appreciating it for a day seems really worthwhile. And I think it makes people happy. People are like, yeah, the lake is really great.
Summer is the best time to be by here. I was just driving over the bridge the other day, and I was like, God, you know, some of the other months of the year might be a little bit tough, but it's good to be here in the summer.
Yeah, it's so pretty right now.
Well, what are some of the events that you've got planned going into this weekend then?
Well, we've got about 10 different organizations that are going to have informational and kind of family fun tables set up down on Barker's Island. We have 2 musical acts coming, Superior Siren, which is sort of a female powerhouse vocals band that I think is doing some great music rising in the Twin Ports right now. And then Woodblind, which is an acoustic ska duo that plays really fun, danceable music. So it's going to be an upbeat day music-wise. We'll have Lake Superior trivia going through the day. We'll have a little raffle. The tickets are free. So you can win prizes. We have free stand-up paddleboarding happening on Superior Bay right off the island, so you can come anytime from 11 to 3 for that. And we also have a sneak peek of our new Lake Superior Estuarium, which is our public exhibit hall. We don't have exhibits yet, but we will have a finished mural by this weekend, so people can take a peek at that.
So what's going to be going into the exhibit hall then?
Well, it's going to be focused on the St. Louis River Estuary and the Lake Superior watershed, and it's a little different than a lot of exhibit halls you might have been to in that it's not just focused on nature, it's not just focused on habitats, but it's really focused on how people interact in the St. Louis River. So you'll see a lot of stories about the St. Louis River Area of Concern and the restoration that's happening in the river right now. You'll see a lot of stories about wild rice and about the history of the St. Louis River Estuary. And you'll see, you know, shipping and industry included in that. But there's also a lot of really fun kids games and interesting interactives and short videos you can watch to learn more about the St. Louis River. I think it'll be great for visitors and people who live here in Superior.
And so why is it important to have exhibits like that that inform people about the work that's going on around the lake and just, you know, some of the things that are happening with wildlife or plants or fish, anything?
Well, you know, I think people drive by the St. Louis River Estuary or the estuaries along Wisconsin's south shore of Lake Superior and we don't really realize what they are. You know, if we were on the saltwater coast, we'd be like, oh, that's a slough, that's an estuary. And we'd maybe have a little better idea of what that means, but here it's a little different. But really, these river mouths feed the lake in a big way. They provide nutrients to the lake. They provide spawning grounds for fish and wildlife. They provide great migratory bird habitat, and they provide a really important protected shipping port for us. So it's a really interesting story, but I think it's a little invisible because the lake is so massive, and we see that. We don't see how important these rivers are that come into the lake.
So on Lake Superior Day this weekend, as we kind of reflect about the beginnings of the celebration and where we are now, is Lake Superior better off, or is there still a lot of work that has to be done?
Yes and no. Yes. Lake Superior is definitely, you know, post-Clean Water Act, particularly on the St. Louis River, which is the largest U.S. tributary to the largest freshwater lake in the world by surface area. This river really benefited from a lot of cleanup efforts that have taken place in Wisconsin and Minnesota with a lot of partnerships through the past 30 years. We can swim in this water now. We can fish in this water. We still have, issues. We still deal with mercury. We're still dealing with trying to bring back some of the very rich, abundant habitat that was here. And we're still dealing with sediment contamination. So we're dealing with some old stuff, and then we're dealing with some new stuff. You know, mercury is kind of an emerging issue that we're trying to figure out how to address. And that affects Lake Superior as well. And I think, you know, we have emerging pollution issues that we're kind of trying to keep track of. And the lake is getting warmer. What is that going to mean? You know, the lake has increased 2 degrees over the past 15 years, whereas the land has only increased an average of 1 degree over the last 15 years. So the lake is getting warmer faster, and we're trying to understand what that's going to mean for the habitat there.
So, but is there anything that you look at as kind of the number one threat to, you know, Lake Superior?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's sort of the big two that we have right now on Lake Superior, and one is climate change, warming water, more winds, or higher wind speeds, bigger storms, which we've all experienced in the last few years. And, you know, those are climatic changes over time, so not necessarily weather, but we can see them in the weather sometimes. And then invasive species, you know, as we have, for example, Asian carp approaching in various locations, you know, not close yet. We're not nearly as close as Lake Michigan, but that's a new threat. And we have a lot of invasive plants and invasive fish and even tiny things like spiny water flea that we're trying to deal with and trying to understand how they affect the ecosystem and address the way they affect things like the fishery, for example. So climate, invasive species, I think those are really impactful things that are happening right now. Land use, particularly in urban areas or in the upper watershed, is something that we also need to pay attention to, because the land use issues, so things running off the land into the water, are issues that can be exacerbated or made worse by both climate change and the invasive species issues we're dealing with. So kind of got a lot of balls up in the air to keep an eye on.
Right. And when you're talking about addressing some of these issues that come up related to climate change and invasive species, right now we're in a situation where President Trump has proposed eliminating funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and cuts to the EPA. What could that mean for, you know, addressing threats or challenges that are facing Lake Superior?
Well, I think we can look to the past. You know, we really had a period of time where we didn't manage what we put into water. And, you know, by mid-1970s, the St. Louis River was really effectively considered dead. It had no oxygen in it, so there was not a lot of life in here. We've done a lot since then, and I think we can really learn from that. You know, what we've done has worked. The St. Louis River is not dead anymore. It is a very alive place. And I think that should be an important basis for decision-making, is what actually works, what has been working for water quality, the quality of life, and what I see as a really thriving, dynamic, and growing economic engine in the Twin Ports right now.
Well, any plans that you have then for Lake Superior Day?
I'm going to dance. I'll probably dance.
Sounds like a good plan.
It's really fun. Yeah, it's fun to have a lot of, you know, we get a lot of kids that come down and families that come down, and people just come and sit and listen, and it's honestly a really fun event to put on.
Again, that was Deanna Erickson with the Lake Superior Research Reserve. The events run from 11 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon on Sunday at Barker's Island. You can find out more information about events in your area at lakesuperior.com. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but stick around, there's more to come. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Roller derby got its start in the early 20th century. The popularity of the sport grew during the 60s and 70s, but its modern-day counterpart isn't about the glitz, glamour, and theatrics as seen on TV. As Elizabeth McMahon reports, the women of the Twin Ports Harbor City Roller Dames leave it all on the track.
The Harbor City Roller Dames hit the skating rink to practice for upcoming bouts with teams across the Midwest. Skating captain Kate Minear says the sport saw a resurgence in the early 2000s. Harbor City Roller Dames held their first matches almost a decade ago.
It's a great community. It's a great way to get into a group sport, especially a contact sport, at an adult level that's amateur. I didn't grow up playing sports, so I don't have any of that years of experience to come into trying to get onto some co-ed league of some random sport that I've never done. Roller derby, we all kind of start at the same basic level. So it's really easy to get into and to work on your skills and to make lasting friendships as you go.
Hey everybody, it's time for roller games. Are you ready?
The TV show Roller Games televised the sport in the late 1980s with glittery outfits, colorful commentary, and a predetermined winner. The show was more about theatrics than the sport. But that's not the case for the Dames and Katie Dahl. Katie is a blocker and jammer on the team, better known by her skater name, Delinquent.
We're athletes and we train. We take care of our bodies. We work on endurance and strategy and her physical abilities. And I just want to be taken seriously.
Dahl, like many of the girls on the team, say they skate because they love it and they get a lot out of it.
Oh man, I get so much out of roller derby. Well, for one, it's the first like sport I've ever been involved with, really, except for I played soccer for a year in fourth grade. That doesn't count. The first team sport I've ever been involved with. It's so accepting and welcoming of any kind of person, no matter your age, your gender, your physical ability, everything. So it's just a really good community of people, and the sport is awesome, and the camaraderie is awesome, and the networking is awesome, and it's all great.
Everything except one downfall of derby duels. Injuries.
Look out!
The goal of any derby bout is to make laps around your opponent without getting knocked off the track by skaters from the other team, so safety is pretty important to everyone involved. All the girls wear helmets, knee pads, elbow pads, wrist guards, and mouth guards. Michelle Connedy is the assistant manager of the Dames, better known to her teammates as Molly McNaughty. She says her worst injury came just days after she made it on the team.
I fell back on my wrist and I broke my wrist even with my wrist guard on. But I kept skating. I just couldn't do contact while I had my cast on because they were concerned that I might accidentally hit somebody and take them out with my cast. It's pretty hard and heavy.
After practice, the girls stretch out, bruised and exhausted. For some like Alex, Axel, Ross, roller derby is a place to work out frustrations from daily life.
My goal is to relieve some work stress so I can't bring that here. You know, I have to kind of put myself in the mental space to play the game and enjoy it and be challenged by it and have fun with it.
Ross feels roller derby has come a long way as a sport.
It has evolved so much, I think, from what many people remember as something that was so much showmanship and kind of craziness. So there's so much strategy involved and so much thought that kind of goes into how different teams even play, because there's so many different styles of derby.
Ross says each skater brings their own unique moniker and skills.
Like pieces of glitter in a water bottle that are floating around just randomly.
So maybe there's still some glitz left in the game after all. The way these girls roll, they hope their skill for the sport will make a name for the dames. Elizabeth McMahon, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.